Blog Talk Radio.
Live from Myrtle Beach, South Carolina, the vacation capital of the world and the golf capital of the world, this is the one and the only Scarycast. We are so excited. We got a tremendous show lined up for tonight. First of all, I want to introduce our co-hosts. Excuse me. First of all, from the Midlands of South Carolina, the one and only Dr. Trey Donaway, our Surgeon General. How are you doing tonight, Trey?
I'm doing good, John. Had a nice day today. The weather was okay. It was very nice.
Well, that's good. Glad you did. And our man from West Hollywood, the one and the only, Devin Tate. How are you doing tonight?
Hey, John. I'm good. I'm happy to be here. Sorry I missed last week, but we took a little vacation up to Solvang, which is a little Danish city out in the valley up above Santa Barbara, California. So that was a fun trip, and now I'm happy to be back here with you all.
Well, we're glad to have you back. Tonight we have a doubleheader. From 9 to 10 Eastern, we have Ralph Jarrells, accomplished author. He's done great work. We've had him on before, and we're so glad to have him back again. And from 10 to 11, our own, the Queen of Scarycast, Robin McCrae, Bigfoot habituator herself, talking about Bigfoot. So we're going to have a blast tonight. Ralph Jarrells from up in the Columbia area, how are you doing tonight?
Very good. Thank you, John. Having a wonderful day, and I'm just happy to be on talking about one of my favorite characters, Anne Bonny.
Well, that's great. Yes, just so that people who don't know, Anne Bonny was the first real live female pirate over here in the New World, and she was in the earlier part of the 1700s. And Ralph, start off the discussion and tell us what a cool cat Anne Bonny really was.
Well, John, Anne Bonny was born in Kinsale, Ireland. Her father, John Cormack, was an attorney, and actually her mother was a maid that worked for John and his wife, and the wife had to be away from home for an extended time for medical purposes, and John fell in love with the maid, and the result was Anne. And since that time period, good Catholic families did not have divorce, so they had to make a choice, and the choice was John and Mary Cormack. Came to Charleston with their 1 to 2 year old child, who was Anne at that time, Cormack. And
okay.
Anne was quite a little character. At about age eight, Anne's mother died, and Anne didn't have any way to deal with that, except that she was very angry. And so not long after that, at school, one of the boy bullies, who was a few years older than her, made some comments and anyway, just had enough. She had enough, and so she beat him up, sent him home from school, and he was out for a week because of the injuries she inflicted on him. And again,
so
that would have been about age.
So she was a tough, tough girl then, right?
She was. She was a tough little girl with a bad attitude. But anyway, that's sort of how this all started. And then her father couldn't tell her why her mother died. And without having a good explanation, she just, she was against everyone in the world. And one particular evening, she decided to go riding. She had a horse at the plantation they lived in. She had went riding and came upon a place called the Pink House. The Pink House in Charleston is still standing, actually. It's at 17 Chalmers Street, which is right in the old town of Charleston. And it at that time was a combination groggery and brothel, and that's where the pirates hung out. And Anne went in, and even though she was only about 14 years old, she went in and it was a place where everyone was happy, or at least appeared to be. And everyone was accepted exactly who they were, where they were. And so she really enjoyed that. And that came a time not long after her first visit that she met a guy named James Bonney. And James told her that he was the captain of a pirate ship. And fact of the matter is he was a ne'er-do-well pirate on any ship that he could get passage on. But, you know, he convinced her that he was a captain. And so they decided to get married. And they got married. He booked passage on a ship and told her that, you know, it was not good luck for a woman to be on, so she had to dress like a man. And she did that, and in my story, she showed her father had been teaching her to use a saber, and so she actually bested the finest swordsman on the ship, and it's a funny story, but that's in the book. So anyway, they ended up going to Nassau, and that's when she found out that John was not who he said he was. And that was the beginning of the story of Anne Bonney. She became a pirate. She ultimately joined the crew of the Revenge, which was Jack Rackham, Calico Jack Rackham's ship. And they ended up pirating for a couple of years in and around Nassau and in the Caribbean.
So Ralph, let me stop you. So what you're saying, Anne grew up quickly and became tough and became a pirate.
You're kind of digitalizing, John. You're fading on us.
Sorry about that. I'll move around occasionally. Is that a little bit better?
Yeah, I think you need to get closer to your base.
It's okay. Well, that's a little bit better because we're right next to it.
Pretty unintelligent.
Why don't you take over? Dr. Trey, you say, I'll see what I can do.
Okay. You work on the electronics, and I'll talk to Ralph. Ralph, you know, this is a very fascinating time in the history of the development of the colonies and in the Caribbean in and of itself. From my understanding, the British employed privateers with letters of marque. And those letters of marque allowed legal piracy, as long as you were pirating on the enemy, which at the time was Spain.
Right.
And then they made peace with Spain, and all of a sudden you had a bunch of people who were really good at piracy under their letters of mark, who were basically unemployed. And a lot of the pirates decided, well, why don't we just do it on our own? And we don't have to split the profits with anybody. So I think that's a, you know, an economically driven decision to become pirates. And I think Anne Bonny was, she was thrown into the midst of all of that with Calico Jack and Steed Bonnet and all these famous pirates. And I cannot remember the year of all this, but wasn't it in the first half of the 18th century? I don't remember the years.
The age of piracy in the Caribbean was from about 1650 to 1720. And Anne Bonny was in there for the last 2 to 3 years before she and Jack Rackham were captured. And she was just a bigger-than-life human. I mean, certainly she was a woman that was out of her time, but she was bigger than life for the men as well. And
well, she kind of left her husband in the dust, her first husband, and then she was with Rackham, wasn't she? Was that Calico Jack or?
That's Calico Jack, Jack Rackham. He John Bonny, when they got to Nassau, she found that he was not what he said he was, what he was, and that their life was really, first of all, Nassau was dirty, filthy, nasty place, and the majority of residents who were pirates, and the women that were there were hookers or whores, and that's or prostitutes, and that's what they thought she was until she showed how strong she was. And there's a lot of stories, and I tried to keep my book is called Fiery Red Hair, Emerald Green Eyes, and a Vicious Irish Temper, because that was a good description of who she was. But I've tried to keep my story as close to the facts that I could find as possible. I wanted it to be historically as correct as possible, and then took into account that, you know, she would have, and she actually took on a personality of her own as a character. And I guess the best way to describe her as the book, in the book, is that she was like a female Jack Sparrow. She had a smart mouth, but she could certainly back it up. And I found out a lot of things. First of all, there is a breach in the history at the time when she is released from prison. They were captured, she and Mary Read, who was also a woman and was on the same ship with Jack Rackham, were arrested and put in jail in Jamaica. And there, Mary Read died. They were put in jail because they were both pregnant. They had both been sentenced to hang, but the law there wouldn't allow them to hang a pregnant woman. So then they were both pregnant. They both ended up in jail. And the best information I have historically is that her father paid the Jamaican governor to release her, and they took her, he got her and took her back to Charleston. But that's where historically, she disappears. So from that point forward, my story is more logic and something that fits in with the whole concept of her and what she did.
So when she came back to Charleston, mediated by her lawyer dad, she was pregnant?
Yes.
And presumptively she would have had the baby, and maybe that's why, I mean, I would imagine she created a little bit of a stir in Charleston society.
Yes, and again, looking at the logic, she would have been sent away from Charleston because it just would have made sense. And so in the book, I have her going to a friend of her father's in and around Barnwell, and the baby was born there. The baby ended up being a whole lot like, like Anne was when she was little. And the story, the novel, is actually Anne telling her own story to her granddaughter. And so it's presented me with the opportunity to be to try to phrase things from the point of view of a woman. It's been a long time since I was a woman, and even longer since I was a teenager, a teenage girl. So the whole thing is offered some interesting opportunity for me, anyway. I know this is called Scarycast, and so at some point in time, I think we should talk about the weird, unusual, scary spiritual things that happened during the writing of the novel and subsequent. The Pink House.
Oh, Ralph, well, I didn't even know about that aspect.
Yeah.
Hey,
Ralph. Ralph, this is Dr. John. Am I a little clearer now?
Much
you
clearer.
Are,
sounds
you
like
are.
You got a fresh battery, John.
Something like that. I restarted everything, so we're lucky we're still here. All right, Ralph, tell us about the paranormal aspect of writing this book.
Well, I know that first of all, this was new to me because I had never tried or never understood the idea of automatic writing. But a lot of this book I had to go back and read because I didn't know that I was writing it. Now, whether you want to believe that Anne Bonny was helping me or whatever you wish to believe, it's certainly possible. And I think we'll see more of that as the story goes along. And the groggery or the place where Anne met John Bonny is the Pink House in Charleston. And that's located at 17 Chambers Street. And I decided to go down and see it for myself. And so my wife and I went down and drove around and ended up parking and was able to walk around the house. And there was a strange, eerie feeling, like, a spirit was there. I subsequently found out that the city of Charleston, city tours list the Pink House as being a haunted house, haunted by Anne Bonny's ghost. I don't know. Could be or not. But the story, my story goes further than that. My wife and I, my son and his fiance went to Kinsale 2 years ago. Now, that's where she was born. I was doing a book signing, and my son and his fiance went out to Old Head, which is a golf course there near Kinsale, nationally known quality European golf course. On the way back, they found a sign that said, "This is the birthplace of one of Ireland's most famous women, Pirate Anne Bonny." And nothing would do that they wouldn't have me come there, and since I wrote the book, to be take photographs in front of the marker. Now I've been a photographer for, I'm 78, so about at least 60 years. But anyway, they took a picture of me and Sybil in front of this marker. And when I got home, I looked at it, and there are at least 8 or 9 orbs covering the picture. Now, I'm told that I looked online and I found that that orbs are generally considered a means whereby the spirit world speaks to our world or indicates the desire to. So in the picture, there are at least 2 clear orbs, and they say that is a sign that an entity is trying to communicate with you. There's 1 blue orb, and that says that is believed to be the spirit associated with truth and energy, and that it's generally believed that people associate it with the fact that there is spiritual guidance involved. There were 2 red orbs, associated with the idea of safety and security, that you could be safe in accepting what the orbs or what the spirit has to say. And finally, there was 1 pink orb, which is a message of love or caring. Now, you know, again, everybody can believe what they want to on this, but this actually happened, and I have the photograph. I believe the indication is that there is more to Anne's story that needs to be told. And so one of the things that I was hoping Robin would be available for would be to see if there is a means to communicate with Anne Bonny's spirit. And, you know, if that happens, it will, I hope, provide direction on how Anne Bonny's book number 2 would go. But subsequently, we've had friends in Kinsale actually find what is believed over there to be Anne Bonny's grave in a churchyard in Columbia County that is in Castlelands, which is right outside of Kinsale. So, you know, the book, I think, is a pretty good read, but the doors that have opened and the spiritual or the secondary part of what's opened as a result of the book is the thing that is most amazing to me and most enticing to do more research and actually try to write the second level of the novel.
And Ralph, you mentioned that you got involved with automatic writing. What do you mean by that? What does that imply?
Well, that it's directed by something other than me and my experience or my knowledge, my ability to write. And it's almost like facts that come out that aren't readily available in research. The whole concept of writing this, it was just really quick. I wrote the entire manuscript in less than a month, and for me, that's a quick time. So,
and when you said you wrote it, is this longhand or is this typing?
No, on the computer. Yeah,
on the computer. But it's just a kind of a flow of information that you might not even have been aware of, that just kind of
correct
came out?
Not aware of, and not as if I were directing it. It was like a free flow. So, and you know, there are times where I sit and question myself about that, because that's not something that I would naturally come to that as a conclusion of why I did it. But it was suggested that I should look into it. And it's something that the definition that I found was that it was a place outside of conscious awareness.
So were you aware of it at the time you were writing, or were you aware of it after the fact?
After the fact.
How interesting. What if you think back on when you were typing, do you remember? Or was there a shift in time? Like, you know, it was 2 o'clock and all the next thing you know, it's 3:30 and you've written a whole bunch of stuff.
No. And at that time, I really didn't even think to try to figure that out. It was just the flow of the stories, the words were just so easy to come that I just kept typing. And I would type for hours, but and I don't know exactly how to put that into words, other than I realized that it was flowing, and you know, I would prefer to think that it was egotistically here, is that I would prefer to think that I was just, you know, on a roll, so to speak. But then when I finished, I actually ended up going back through the book and reading it for a second time, and I said, well, now I wonder where that came from. So there were pieces.
Were there any idioms or phrases that it would be foreign for you to write based on just, you know, how your style? Did you see any stylistic differences or an idiom that you'd never really put together that was apparent on the transcript?
No, but the ideas are what would be, they would not be natural for me to even think about. Mm-hmm. I don't know if that actually relates, but the whole concept of, you know, what being a pirate was like, I have no personal knowledge and even didn't even do research on that. And yet it's clear and evident in the story.
So I take it, Ralph, you've never worked for a lawyer or
no.
An insurance company or anything like that?
No.
You wouldn't. I wouldn't know what a pirate was like either.
No.
This is Dr. John. I wanted to explain something because I am a little bit familiar with automatic writing. Many people, you know, those that have experienced it have basically started writing and they've blacked out and they've come back and they've written page after page after page of things that they really don't know much about. Rudyard Kipling, who wrote Kubla Khan, the first stanzas of it, he said that became automatic writing. He had no idea where it came from, and he got woken up by his wife, who tapped him on the shoulder. He got out of the trance, and all of a sudden he has, you know, stanzas of some of the greatest poetry in modern time. So the fact is, automatic writing is it has early on been associated with the Ouija board, people can get on the Ouija board and the Ouija board can dictate things. That is one way that automatic writing happens. Another way is when you simply become into a trance and you start writing and all of a sudden you wake up, you don't know where the thoughts came from. A number of writers, Dorothea Brandt, who wrote one of the most amazing books on creative writing called On Becoming a Writer. Dorothea Brandt talks about the fact that creative writing, which is what we're talking about, Ralph, that creative writing really comes from somewhere else. You get in a certain mode and it just flows. And so, I mean, she explained it, but she was talking about automatic writing. She did not know that. Her background was not in parapsychology or anything like that. But she talked about creative writing as being something that comes from somewhere else and that you tap into it. Well, that is apparently what you have done, and one would think that your story has a lot more veracity and a lot more truthfulness because you really don't know where it came from. Am I correct?
Well, I hope that's true. But, yes, I did not know where it came from. I don't recall the idea of being in a trance, but I also don't recall writing some of the stuff, so I guess that wasn't a trance.
So, yeah, that's automatic writing, and it can be the best form of communication because you had access to thoughts that you would never have had consciously otherwise, and that's what automatic writing is. It's a phenomenon. It is very much understudied. There are, you know, Edgar Cayce talks about automatic writing. There are various bits and pieces, but you know that's a great topic that certainly deserves a little bit more research. And Trey, I'm glad I guess you weren't really familiar with it, but there is a body of literature about automatic writing, and it's associated with the early psychics. They would get into a trance and just start writing. They would have messages from beyond, and I don't know. I think it's a powerful and interesting technique. So, Ralph, I'm glad to know that automatic writing, you believe, took a part in your Anne Bonny experience.
Well, I feel like it because, again, going back to when it was written, there are parts of the book that I feel like are written very well, and I don't, you know, I just don't necessarily think that I'm that good of a writer, but the continuation of that, the orbs and the continually opening pieces, new information like the Anne Bonny grave and just a lot of things that I have no clear, easy explanation for. And I'm, you know, very honestly, I'm happy that it happened, and I don't care whether I totally understand it or not. The book is what it is, and I mean,
Ralph, has that happened previously or subsequently to that experience? Has it happened again?
You know, it happened a little bit in Jesus Judas, because also I had no knowledge of the lifestyle and whatnot in the area around Israel in 30 AD, but not nearly to the extent that it did in Anne Bonny.
And when you photograph those orbs, were you aware of anything at the time, or did this just become manifest on looking at the exposed film?
Okay. My wife and I were standing in front of this marker that said, "This is the birthplace of Anne Bonny." My son's fiance took a picture with my camera, and it was afterwards I found the orbs in it. And, you know, it's easy to say, oh, it could have been an apparition of the camera, but I'm familiar with all of that. And it was not a sunny day. It was overcast, so there was it was not caused by sun flares.
Nope. No flares.
You know, the other possible explanation is, oh, well, it was a dusty camera lens, and I checked that, and there was nothing wrong with the camera lens, and it was perfectly clean. So there just didn't seem to be any logical, concrete explanation for any kind of apparition on the picture. And that's when I started looking at orbs. Somebody said, you know, you should look into orbs, that they're made, you know, it's a spiritual way of the spirit world talking to the, or trying to get the attention of the concrete world. And then I found this about the, what I said earlier about the orbs and what color they were and what that is said to mean.
All right. Devin, you still there with us?
Yeah, I am, yes.
Okay, good.
And I have a question.
Good, I want to ask. Okay, and then I've got a question of you that relates to this.
Sure.
So, yes, please. What is your question?
Yeah, well, I was really interested in the photo that you were talking about with the orb, because it actually reminded me, and you also had mentioned, you know, hopefully maybe Robin can help us maybe get in touch with Anne Bonny. A while back on this show, Robin helped me communicate with one of my good friends who passed on recently. And just a couple of weeks ago, we all went to a concert, one of the first indoor concerts I've been to for, you know, a year and a half. But it was one of our favorite bands that we used to go see every year with my friend Amy, who passed away. And after the show, we took a picture with the keyboard player from the band. And when we looked at the picture, sure enough, there was a really big orb right there, right in front of the three of us. And we just all knew immediately that that was Amy. Like, it was just so clear that she was obviously there and, you know, manifesting in that photo. So I do hope Robin can help us, because she really, you know, just was amazing with her insight, helping me talk with Amy. But my question is, during the writing process, did you have any sort of like feeling like maybe in a dream, or like maybe you woke up and remembered something that you didn't remember being there before? Because that's how I found I have been able to kind of communicate or hear or learn a lot of things that I wouldn't normally know about. I think it can come through when you're asleep, especially through your dreams. So I was just curious if you had any experience like that while you were writing the book.
Absolutely. On at least half a dozen occasions, I would wake up and have to get up and come in and write. And it was from, well, it, you know, like something happened in a dream that made me end up writing a part of the story. So, yes, that happened. And like I say, at least a half a dozen times.
Wow, that's awesome.
I think that's sometimes called the writer's coma.
Yes. Devin, you don't know, but writing has never been my forte necessarily. I spent almost 50 years in advertising and marketing, and only after I retired did I start writing. And the whole concept of writing, I had an idea for a story that actually began when I was in a teenager and going to church, that the story is about the 30 pieces of silver Judas was given. And to me, that was an extremely important talisman to the Christian religion. And yet it's only mentioned essentially one time after the coins were given to Judas. He threw them in the synagogue, and then they bought a itinerant cemetery. And then it disappears. And so I had questions, and thanks to my parents, I grew up Southern Baptist, and you know, those are things you don't ask to church, and I did, of course, and was told that I needed to read the Bible and not worry about trying to find what wasn't in there, read what was in there. So that's good Southern Baptist way of doing business. But anyway, that was the basis of the first novel, which took me 40 years to write. Not that I worked at it consistently, but I just would write a little bit and put it away for a couple years and write a little bit more. But after I retired, my wife said, you've got that novel, why don't you finish it? And so I said, okay, I will, since she was interested. And I wrote, finished the manuscript, and I've heard all the horror stories about writers and about dealing with publishers. And so I actually postponed sending it to anybody because I felt like they would just turn it down, and that would be the end of that. But I found a guy who is an independent publisher, and I said, you know, this might be the guy that I should work with. And so I got to his website, and it said, for submitting a manuscript, do this, 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 and this. So I followed his directions, actually put the package together and sent it Saturday evening. Sunday during church, I got a notice on my phone that I had received an email. When I got home, the email was from him saying that he had gotten the manuscript. He was interested in what I sent him, and that included only the first 25 pages. And so he said he would like to read the entire manuscript. And anyway, within a little over a month, the book was published. So I'm not uncomfortable with the unusual happening to me, because it does that quite often.
Well, that's great. I think as a writer, it's really important to be open to all of that, you know, where ideas may come from or where inspiration may take you or even where opportunity may present itself.
And that's the way I feel about it is you just do day to day and live for the best of that moment. But creatively and professionally, I've had the experience that I achieved greater than I thought I could, but that's okay too.
Yeah, I think that's kind of how the human brain works. I know personally, I wouldn't know if I'd call it automatic writing or have it associated with paranormal, but I've come up with two ideas that I based a whole separate career on for about 10 years. One of them popped into my brain when I was taking a shower, and one of them popped into my brain when I was riding a lawnmower. And,
right.
You know, your mind's kind of in neutral. You're doing something that's kind of automatic, if you would. And
right.
You're not really thinking about anything in particular. And all of a sudden, it's like Saul on the road to Damascus, where something crashes into your brain. You go, ooh, I got to write that down.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
It's a very curious way our minds work that way.
Right. And that's why I guess I said I was not familiar with automatic writing. I really wasn't until someone suggested, you know, it sounds to me like you've been doing some automatic writing. And so I said, well, let me look that up. So I did some research, just like I did for the orbs and the picture. I had no idea what they were, but they weren't normal for photography that I'm familiar with. So that's mm-hmm. when I started looking up what could the orbs mean. And it just all, particularly with Anne Bonny, it just, these things just happened. And I'm happy. The books, you know, sooner or later somebody may want to make a movie out of it. But until that happens, I'm happy with having my name on the book about her. So,
now, did you say you're going to have a second book perhaps on that?
That's what I'm thinking, and that's why I want to do the contact with Robin or with some credible psychics, and I believe Robin would be, and based on what Devin said, she's probably quite good at it. But I would like to, I think that more of her story needs to be told than I was able to tell at the time. And I just want to find out if that's what my role in this is or should be.
Ralph, from the historical record, what happened to Anne when she returned to Charleston? Now, I take it Calico Jack was hung as a pirate.
He was hung, yeah.
So when she came back, she was pregnant with presumptively his child and had the baby in the colonies again. And do you know what happened to her after she returned?
There is no clear historical data to say what happened to her. There is a story that said she lived, married a guy, had 8 children, and lived in the Charleston area. Now, the story of Anne Bonny began, and this is in the opening of the book. I was at a good friend of mine's house. We were having dinner, and afterwards we were in front of a nice roaring fireplace, and I think we had an Irish whiskey or so, and that started me talking about the novel that I was writing, and his mother, who had spent time in Charleston, when I got finished with my monologue, she said, "You really should look at writing a story about Anne Bonny." And I said, "Who is that?" Now, at this time, I grew up in South Carolina. My mother's family is from Charleston. and I was working for the state at that time. And so I should have, you know, logic would say that if she was as well known as she was, then I should have known about her, but I didn't. So Ms. Herbert told me the story that she had. Now, the reason she knew the story is because her husband was in the Royal Navy in England and was assigned to Charleston as a Royal Navy liaison to the 6th Naval District. So they moved to Charleston, and Miss Herbert was sort of active in the social world in Charleston, particularly because of her husband being, a Royal Navy officer. So she said that Anne Bonny and I use the plantation name of Goose Creek Plantation, but she did not indicate which plantation, but she said that Anne Bonny's father, who was an attorney from Ireland, had come to the United States with his daughter, and they lived in a plantation. And all she knew was that that they lived there when Anne Bonny became a pirate. Well, I started doing the research, and at the point of her probably coming back to the United States, to the colonies, there's no good documented history of what happened to her. So,
and the father probably was not interested in there being much of a documented history. I mean, I think the father, your daughter is a pirate and she's pregnant and unmarried. He was probably happy to keep it on the down low.
Yeah, in 1720 or 1721, that was not the ideal position for someone who was well positioned in the social life of Charleston.
Charleston society, yeah, that wouldn't. That probably wouldn't win her a lot of friends.
Right.
Yeah, especially in 1720. Oh my God.
Yeah. So that's the basis for the book and the possibility of the second one. I've done some research on it, but I'm not. I really was interested in trying to, if there is a way. First of all, if the orbs mean what the research says they do, they mean, and if that's correct, then there is some, I need to find some way to see where the communication is coming from and what additional information I need to have. And maybe, you know, I'm open to the idea that I may be overthinking this too. Then I could go back and just do more automatic writing if that's, or at least be open to it.
And that might be the best thing, Ralph. It really might. One never knows what comes through automatic writing, but it's interesting.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Well, I like the fact, Ralph, that you are writing about a very strong woman in the early 18th century, because there are not a lot of strong women that are written about. So I think I think it's wonderful that you chose that. You know, one of my favorite strong women in South Carolina was born, I just looked it her up, in 1722, and that's Eliza Lucas Pinckney, who developed indigo. And again, very strong woman. George Washington was a pallbearer at her funeral, and her sons were involved in politics and very prominent family. But again, she was a self-made man, or self-made woman, a daughter of a prominent low country planter, and she ended up developing indigo to the point where she could make an excellent profit from it. And again, another strong woman, same time period, born just about by the time Anne Bonny would be returning back to Charleston.
Right. There was no other than I thought it would be a good story. I just feel like that's a part of this South Carolina's history that isn't really talked about. And I'm not sure exactly why. Now, I know the character Anne Bonny has been somewhat more sensationalized thanks to Dark Sail. And I don't know. I've watched a couple of those, and it seems like it's more for sensationalism rather than for any kind of reasonable historic fact. But, you know, that's also Hollywood, so I should not even consider the two at the same time, I guess.
Okay. That's interesting, Ralph. Yeah, I would say what Scarycast would like to do, because now, Devin, we have never really done a final recap of the Blue Ribbon prediction of Robin McRae. And we have not really, on the website, we have not talked about the result, which I think would be important. And we need to do a show where we talk about that. And then, Ralph, we also have the photographs of you and the orbs, and let Robin prognosticate on those. So to give her, you know, in all fairness to Robin, let's let her see the evidence, like, and we'll talk about what she determined about the Blue Ribbon episode of, now, what was your friend's name, Devin?
Amy.
Amy, right. So, I mean, I think, in all fairness to Robin, that would be a very, very interesting thing. And, in fact, here's Robin, because she's going to be with us for hour two. And I'm going to ask Robin, let me let her get on.
Hello.
Hey, Robin, how are you doing?
I'm good. How are you guys?
Great. I've got a question for you. We've got Ralph Gerrels. We've got Devin. We've got Dr. Trey, and we've got me. And we were looking at doing a part two of the Anne Bonny talk that Ralph has just done, and do it in a very interesting way. Do you remember Devin's friend Amy?
Yeah.
That you got those very strong vibes of Blue Ribbons.
Yeah, she told me about that. She said that it meant a great deal to her.
Well, that's right. And it turned out to be, I'm going to leave it a little cloaked right now, it turned out to be what it was. It was very obvious, and Devin found the absolute evidence just stuck away in his closet, which is wonderful. And we've never really had on Scarycast a recap of that, number one. Number two, we have the very, very famous female pirate, Anne Bonny, and Ralph Gerrels, who's with us tonight, has got some very interesting information and some photographs. And I was wondering, next week, Ralph, would you be available to come back during our first hour and talk a little bit about Anne and give me the pictures so I can put the pictures up online and let Robin see them for the first time and get her her take on them. Would that be okay?
That would be fine. I'll actually be in Myrtle Beach on next Monday.
Well, that's right, because now tell us what you're going to be doing here in Myrtle Beach.
Well, next Sunday, the 19th, is Talk Like a Pirate Day. And yes.
Arr.
And a good friend of mine there in Myrtle Beach has made arrangements with Dirty Don's Oyster Bar to have a book signing at each of the three locations on the 19th. And so I'll be there doing a book signing for Anne Bonny. We also are going to have someone dressed like Anne Bonny, so it'll be an opportunity to meet her, too, theoretically, anyway. But I'll be doing that next Sunday. So I'll be there Monday evening, but I'll be happy to be on the air.
Well, I think that'd be wonderful, and you and I can exchange all the photos Sunday so that I can get them put up online so that Robin can have an opportunity to look at them and give us her opinion. So, Robin, does that sound like a little bit of fun and intrigue?
Sure. I have a question, and this is probably,
sure.
You may not even have an answer for this. At any time did this Anne, and I know literally nothing about it, I'm sorry, did she disguise herself as a boy?
Yes.
Okay. All right.
She had to because...
She showed me. Yeah. She's
okay.
Got me. She's showing me herself dressed as a boy.
Yeah. Well, she had to be dressed as a boy because in the early 1700s, it was bad luck for a woman to be on a pirate ship.
Okay. I'm really sorry because I don't know anything about her, and I wasn't able to be on here earlier, so I missed it all. But as soon as you guys started talking, she was showing me herself dressed as a boy, and she says, "You don't know how hard it was to do that."
Oh, that's wonderful. And the other part of it, and the pictures that John is talking about, is that I went to Kinsale, Ireland, which is where she was born, and they found my son and his fiancée, who were traveling with my wife and I, found a marker that said this is where Anne Bonny was born. And
Ralph,
so they,
let's stop it right there. Let's stop it right there, because I want to make sure that it's a little bit of a surprise to Robin. And I'll have them up online, and we're going to have it's going to be a fantastic doubleheader with the finalization of Amy from Devin. She was from Los Angeles, right?
Yep.
The finalization of Amy and the blue ribbons, and so we'll have that, and then we'll have these fantastic pictures, and Robin being this is what I call her. She's our psychic, and she's good at it. So she's really good at it. So, we're thrilled to have Robin on here, and Ralph, we're thrilled to have you. And I had no idea what next week was going to bring. And I think that's the nice thing about ScaryCast is we kind of follow our nose, but our nose gets us into really cool stuff. Now, I want to make a special announcement for September the 27th, which is our last show of the month before we hit the first week in October, and John LeMay will be back with us. I have met and found one of the founders of Analog Horror. It is a fantastic genre of film. It is celebrated in The Blair Witch. It is celebrated in the internet channel TV57. And I'm going to spend 2 weeks doing research and learning all about it. And Aidan Quinn is going to be our guest. And it is going to be a phenomenal episode. We're going to have lots of pictures. and we'll teach you what analog horror is. And what's really cool is that in his documentary, Aidan missed a major, major film that is one of my favorites. And we're going to talk about that as well. So we've got 2 weeks of some of the best programming in paranormal and in media on ScaryCast. And so, Ralph, first of all, I want to thank you for being our guest the first hour. You were, as usual, spot on and wonderful. It was exciting to have you here. And now you are welcome to stay and join us as we talk to Robin, because it'll be Devin, Dr. Trey, and me talking to Robin about Bigfoot, because we're excited about the things that she has done. And this month and in October, we want to celebrate some of the things that she's worked on, that she's researched and learned. And that's what our audience is here for. They really want to know what in the heck is going on in the paranormal world. So with that, I'll say officially thank you. You're welcome to stay with us. And I want to introduce the queen of ScaryCast, Robin McCrae. How are you doing tonight?
I'm doing good. Always happy to be here with you guys.
We're thrilled to have you here. And so what I'm going to do, as I promised, I'm going to ask you a question. And then Devin,
okay,
and Trey and Ralph, if Ralph wants to, they're going to ask you some questions. And we're going to explore, because you've got a very deep and well-known history with the Bigfoots. That's been, I think, one of the keys to your paranormal life. And so let me ask you this. How did you first meet the Bigfoot in general? What was the experience? How did it happen? You're on the deck, Robin.
I didn't try to meet them. That was never the goal. I was a toddler, and by the time my mom said I was between 2 and 3, I had an imaginary friend, and who was bigger than my dad, covered in hair, followed me everywhere. By the time I was 4, I had had my first ET abduction, and I had already had sightings of them, and they just have always been there. I don't know or remember a time they weren't. And it doesn't matter where I go. It doesn't matter where I move. It's just that they end up there.
They're there. They're your buddies, right?
They seem to be, yeah. Ran into a few nasty ones, but for the most part, the ones that generally around stay pretty good.
Okay. Well, then after you were a toddler, after you were 3, 4, and 5 years old, how did it proceed?
It was just one of those things that, you know, we lived in the suburbs, but we always had woods around us. And I was drawn to the woods. I would go in there looking, you know, I knew about stick structures by the time I was 4 and 5 years old. And they would, you know, they're telepathic, and they would speak to me verbally. They would speak to me telepathically. And I never knew that not everybody did that. So for me, that was just my normal. I didn't know until I got older and I asked my parents about it that isn't what everybody did. And so I would just, they would talk to me. They would tell me things. They would talk to me about the structures. They would talk to me about everything they did.
Robin, this is Trey, and you know I have a bazillion questions for you.
Pardon?
You know I have a bazillion questions for you.
Oh,
I
yeah.
always do.
And that's a good thing.
You are just a great gateway into the paranormal. And let's start for the listeners let's start from ground zero. What is a Bigfoot?
If I can get the parrot to be quiet. Basically, they are multidimensional. They can be in flesh and blood. They can be...
And by multidimensional, they can be in the dimension that we can perceive and dimensions that we can't
Correct.
Perceive?
Yes. as well as the fact that, as crazy as it sounds, genetically, they are a human hybrid.
Human on one side, what on the other side?
Well, if you speak to the scientists, specifically Dr. Melba Ketchum, who did the study, it states that on the mitochondrial side, which is the mother, that is human. On the nuclear side, which is the father, that is unknown, because that means that there's nothing in any database that you can compare it to. So they have to list that as unknown. Okay, so if you take the scientific part aside and just set it off to the side, I asked them, I just asked them. It was that simple. I'm not a scientist, so what I say has no reflection on the paper. It is not connected with the paper. It's nothing that, you know, this has not come from Dr. Ketchum. Basically, when I asked them, they pointed to me and said, we're human like you, and then they pointed to the stars and said, in star people, which is an ET. That would give you
the unknown genetics on one side and the human genetics on the other side. So that would be a reasonable explanation.
Yeah, it would, and it is. And the thing is, you know, like I said, scientifically speaking, the scientists can't state that it's ET on the father's side, because the only one that has access to the alien DNA is the government. And the government is not going to share that. So for a regular scientist to go in and be able to pull that kind of DNA to compare it to, that isn't going to happen.
And now we hear the word Sasquatch and Bigfoot and Abominable Snowman and all these other descriptors. Is that basically the same entity?
Yeah, it really is. It's the names are really based by location.
Right.
You know, you get up in the Himalayas and the Yeti. If you go into Russia, they call them Snowman or, you know, Wild Man. There's an assortment. Lishi, depending on the area.
Is there appearance? I mean, I have red hair. Somebody else has brown hair. So I would imagine they're individual variations,
there really
hair
are
color in, distribution.
Yeah, there's a lot of misconception on it because, you know, some of them have the conial heads. Others have the more rounded heads like ours. And I tend to see a lot of people say, well, you know, this area, they all have the conial heads. That really, there may be some that are more prone to certain areas, but that's really an incorrect statement. There are no two that are alike, unless they're identical twins. And just like with us, you know, you'll see different people that will have similarities, but unless they are an identical twin genetically, they're not the same. They're not going to be. They have the assortment of hair colors. I have a female named Mwaka that runs around my front yard, and she's got salt and pepper hair. And she's not old. It's just the way she was born. You know, we have, you know, white ones that are not albino, that are not white because they're older. Not that there aren't albinos, just like there are with our people. There are some that their hair will turn gray with age, but there's also some that are just white-haired. You know, I have one I'm very close to named Shadow, and Shadow's skin is actually, I don't want to say dark, but it is, you know, it's a little, it's not an albino color skin at all. And he's white from head to toe except for on his left upper arm. And he's got, it always reminded me of a tattoo, like a lightning bolt tattoo, and it's just a little strip of black hair that he has there. But they're all different. You know, it's like when you go to Japan, you're going to notice facial features are different. And, you know, quite possibly the ones that are there, because they're all over the world. There's no place they aren't, not even the Hawaiian Islands. They have them on there too. I've talked to several people that have had contact with them there. But, you know, there may be different things per se for where they are in the world, but the overall appearance, the conial heads, they have them all over the place, you know, and then they have the same ones that are just as round as ours. That's not limited to location.
How do they describe themselves? If you ask me, what am I? I'd say, well, I'm a human. That's
they say
what I
people.
Would call just a people.
Yeah.
And
yeah, if you ask them what they are, they'll say we're a people.
And what do the people do day to day?
Well, they have their own lifestyle to begin with. They have their own culture. They have their own language. They have their own alphabet. They can read. They can write. They have their own language, yet they can also speak whatever language they're constantly around. You know, so the ones that would per se be in the United States might speak in English as well as their own language. When
and is that
you
learned
to,
from the culture they are in, or is that
yeah, it
inherent
really is.
To the population?
It's not that they, but they can translate it over really easily, because when I was in Siberia and I spoke at the international conference there, the ones that I spoke with in Russia spoke in Russian. And they would mind speak in Russian, and it's like I couldn't understand them. I don't know Russian. I've tried to learn it. I am completely inept at it. It's not ever going to happen. And I would have to tell them I can't understand. If you want me to understand you, I can't understand. And they literally had no problem mind speaking in English. You know, I've not seen any that can't flip it over to whatever language they need to. Now, that doesn't mean that verbally they can do that.
Mm-hmm.
Telepathically, they can do it easily. I think that probably verbally they can to some extent. I have verbally spoken to one out of Russia before, and when he was verbally speaking, he spoke in Russian. You know, I'm not going to say they can't. I think it would be more difficult.
But
you
if
know,
they want to be
telepathic.
If they want to be a universal communicator, then they flip over to the mind speaking part.
Yeah.
And that way they would
right.
they could bypass the specific linguistics that they were raised in.
Exactly. And they all have the ability to mind speak. It's not that they don't. However, they live their lives in clans. And in those clans, and I compare this a lot to the Amish, because Amish, you know, certain sectors of Amish don't use electricity. Others use electricity, but they don't use vehicles or whatever that sector might believe in. And when it comes to them, the Bigfoots are kind of the same way. You have certain groups that refuse to acknowledge the paranormal abilities that they have. It doesn't mean they don't possess them. It means they don't use them.
Mm-hmm.
And they don't teach their children that they have them. So they don't know they have them. And then if they get, as they're older and they per se go to another clan or get a different mate or whatever, and then they turn around and realize, you know, oh, okay, this one's doing this, and they're taught that they have that ability, they absolutely can use it. You know, I mean, and I've spoken of this before. As far as that goes, I think the best one that explains it is Kevin Lang. Kevin found a Bigfoot child out in the woods. Its parents had been killed by the government, and it was basically orphaned. And I believe Kevin was a teenager at the time, and so he would take it food and he'd play with it, and they got to be best buddies. And he never showed any indication of paranormal abilities. And then once the government found out that Kevin was taking care of him, then they were coming for him, and so Kevin moved him. And when he moved him, he got him associated with another clan. That clan did use the paranormal abilities, and now he has no problem using them. I've spoken to him. You know, so it really depends on the group that they're with as far as how much of those abilities they use. Some will speak telepathically, but they won't do anything else. Then you have the other ones that are just like 100% using the paranormal abilities, and they, you know, totally knock us out of the water every day because you can't believe that the things they can do.
When you have a tribe, a colony of Bigfoots, they can be multidimensional. So they can be in this dimension that we occupy, and they can also be in another dimension.
Yes.
That
they just go into a portal.
We don't. What's on the other side of the portal? Or are there multiple dimensions they can be in?
Multiple.
I guess.
Yeah. It's not limited to just one. I mean, I went through it one time, and it was very, very brief. It was like a second long. They had taken me out in the woods to show me where they lived, and it was just like a flash, and I was already in this other area. But there is a multitude of dimensions. I mean, we have dimensional creatures that come in and out of these portals all the time. I have a photograph of a UFO up in the air, a portal underneath of it, and a head coming out that was taken outside my garage door in my yard.
And when do they live in an other? I mean, they can live anywhere, I guess, whichever
yeah,
dimension they chose
they can.
To be in.
I mean,
but
we
but
have
where,
some
where
that
have
say
their,
that
where do they have their houses. Where do they have their or do they have houses? Where do
well,
they where
do
they spend
do,
most
they
of
have
their
what
time?
They call they have shelters that they create. They took me to one time, and it literally looked like Big Bird's nest with a top on it. It was like 4.5 feet off the ground, like the size of a 2.5-car garage, and then you had all these trees and branches and everything bent over the top and woven in it. And it was just enormous. You could have put two large vehicles in it. It was that big. And it was raining like crazy outside, and there was not one drop of water going in there. I mean, when I say it's watertight, it is. And so you have that. But they also will make underground tunnels. They have underground caverns. You'll find, you know, every now and then out in the woods, you'll see these houses that are like from the 16, 17, 1800s or even after that that are abandoned and mm-hmm. are just dilapidated. You'll find them living in there. I mean, they literally can set up shop anywhere. You know, I've talked to others that say they go into the dimensions and go to other places. I have a friend in Texas, and hers come back and forth to my house. Mine will go visit her. It's like we'll be talking on the phone. I'm like, oh, guess who just showed up? You know, and she's like, well, he was here an hour ago. You know, I mean.
Do they sleep? Do they require
absolutely.
Sleep? They can sleep in any of these different dimensions, but is there one dimension in particular where they would have a – I mean, I guess if I was multidimensional, I'd like to visit
well,
other
I
dimensions.
Think primarily
but in order to go
here.
To bed, I'd probably come back to my home because that's
yeah,
where my bed
and they
is.
Do. And they will. It's just like having, you know, like a village, you know. I mean, depending on how many are in that clan. But right. primarily this is their home. That when they go through these portals, it's like us going on an expressway. You know, I've had some talk about, you know, if things get too bad here, they'll go there temporarily and then they come back. But, I mean, really, it's more, to me, it seems to be a way to travel, you know, and be wherever they want to be. But, like I said, there are some that say, you know, at times, if for whatever reason, they'll go in and they'll end up somewhere else. But it is like a travel.
Well, that would
travel.
Also explain why if you go looking for a Bigfoot, if you happen to see one, you might not see them permanently. I mean, they might be there.
No.
And then
no.
they
and
step off
then
into
you
a
have,
portal and
because of the
then they're gone.
But then with the paranormal abilities comes the cloaking. They can do the cloaking. They can do the shimmer. The shimmer looks like a predator, like in the movie Predator, like that gelled
right.
clear figure that's walking around, that's what they call a shimmer. But then they have a cloaking. When they cloak, they bend the light. They're actually right there. You know, there is the theory, and some people believe, including my husband, that at some point in time, it's always been, well, when they do that, do they go into a portal? I've never been able to get them to say that that's what they do. Anytime I've asked them, they just, we never left. We just bent the light. You can't see us. And that's where they do what they call counting coup. Counting coup is where they bend the light so you can't see them, and they walk up behind you or next to you or wherever, and they physically put hands on you. And they used to do it years ago as a rite of passage from the younger ones as they got older, but now a lot of them do it just for fun. I mean, they would go up to me. I'd be out in the woods, and they would come up behind me and just play with my hair, you know, and I'd feel something patting my hair, you
so
know, and
Here's another question. You're in the woods, and
okay.
you encounter something different. what would make you think, oh, this is a Bigfoot, either announcing themselves or playing with me or threatening me? What type of experience might you have that you are not thinking of a Bigfoot, but you're just thinking of, well, that was weird, and then you try to make an explanation? What are some typical encounters where you might not even realize what you just encountered?
Well, in my case, which is a little bit different, I mean, everybody's situations are different, I know how to read energy. So if I'm walking out in the woods, I'm automatically going to pick up the energy that's around me. If it feels like a Bigfoot, then I know there's a Bigfoot around. Then I start looking for signs, because you need to know, is this an aggressive Bigfoot? Is this one that's just following me, or am I being shadowed? Do they want to communicate? There's a multitude of things that can go on with it. But what I tell everybody is you have to be acutely aware of what's going on around you, because they normally, even the aggressive ones, give out certain things that they're going to do to try to get the point across that you're not wanted there. When you leave your front door, you're now in their world.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? And just like if you're sitting home and somebody comes busting through your front door and into your living room where your family's at, you're not going to be happy, and you're going to do whatever you have to do to protect your family, as you should. They're
right.
going to do the same thing. And they don't understand property lines, so that doesn't help. In their culture, those don't exist. They have territories, you know, that they will either allow certain clans to walk through or whatever, or maneuver through, and other ones they won't. So it gets really complicated. So when I go out in the woods, I try to be very much aware of what's going on. I try to keep an eye on what energy do I feel. If I feel like it's not a Bigfoot energy, then I start trying to figure out what it is. You know, certain things feel a certain way. If I can't get that, now I'm even more on guard. We have a lot of cryptids out there that not only the government's created, but the ETs have dropped off, and we don't know what they are. They're just there.
No.
I have one that's been running around my house for years.
How is a cryptid different than a Bigfoot?
Or well, Bigfoot is a cryptid.
Bigfoot a form of a cryptid?
It is. It absolutely is. A cryptid is anything that walks bipedal. And just like with the Bigfoots and the dogmen and the goatmen and the cat people, they can go from 2 feet down on all fours. But they primarily are on two legs. Okay, so bipedal is going to be walking like a man. And
right.
a lot of these hybrids are all crossed with human DNA as well as the ET, and then what other things are with them. Like when, you know, the lizard man. A lizard man, and I have a picture of one in the backyard. And the lizard man is a lizard, a human, and an ET. Cat people, I've got a picture of those too. A feline, a human, an ET. And this is where they get this bipedal gait, is because there's human cross in all of it. Most of those are created by the ETs. However, our government thinks they can play God, and they've created several things as well. Okay? It's very possible the Ebens are the ones that created the dogmen. However, our government decided that they are going to create super soldiers, so they've created their own version of them. And those are worse than anything the ETs could have created. Those are lean, mean, killing machines, and that is basically what they're set there to do. But now, any of your cryptids, any of your dimensionals, elementals, or anything like that, the universal laws, there's good and bad in everything. So you can't say they're all bad. You can't say they're all good. I get several people that are always telling me they're demonic. They are not demonic, okay? Demonic deals with, you know, Satan and the underworld and everything like that, and that is not where these came from. And they are not, and I know a lot of people believe that they are, especially the dogmen. My encounters with the dogmen are not bad. I mean, have I talked to ones before that were aggressive? Absolutely, because I've had people call me that are in situations with some of the aggressive ones. And I have mind spoke with them. But as far as the ones that I've interacted with, I've had nothing but good luck with them. I've not had that experience. I mean, I think probably in my lifetime we've had one or two that have wandered through that were probably not the nicest, but they never attempted anything. They never did a thing.
If one were to encounter a Bigfoot, how what would be the best way for us to relate to that? That
well,
entity?
I know I've been told, and whether or not this part is true, I don't know because it's not panned out that way for me. But I have been told before from different people that I've talked to that have encountered them, you know, don't look them in the eye because that means it's more threatening. I've not had that experience. I was like toe-to-toe with 14-footer. I did not look up in his face only because I thought, well, you know, as close as I am, if that is the case, I don't want to get my head ripped off, so I didn't do it. But I also didn't want to look, I mean, I'm looking at his thigh at that point, and I thought if I look up that high, I didn't want to panic, I didn't want to scream, I didn't want any of these things, so I just stayed nice and calm. And I think he just looked at me as a silly human because he was trying to take my pony that we had for my children, and he had it on a rope, and he was trying to pull the pony in the woods. And like an idiot, I grabbed this rope, and I'm getting hydroplaned across the, you know, the grass because the grass was wet, and I'm getting drug in the woods because I'm trying to save the pony. Like, I don't know why I even attempted it. There's no way I could even for a moment think that I could stop it if he wanted to drag it in. But he ended up, you know, pulling me right along with the pony. And once we got to the woods, I mean, I could see his feet. I could see his knee. I could see part of his thigh. And basically, he just let the rope go. I think he figured, if this woman is so stupid, what do I want with her? Because she's obviously an idiot. So he just kind of turned around and left. But, you know, if you're going to, let's say you're out in the woods and you see one. Number one, you want to stay calm. Panicking, if you panic, they're going to panic because they don't know what you're going to do any more than you know what they're going to do. I tell people, don't turn your back because then you can't see what's going on. Very calmly, you know, don't crowd it. Back up. If, you know, things are going well and you can back up quite a ways, that's fine. Don't try to outrun it. You're never going to. It isn't even possible. I mean, obviously, if you're being chased, you're going to run. But the truth of the matter is you're not going to be able to run fast enough. They're unimaginably quick, not to mention the fact they can maneuver through the trees like nobody's business. But the key to the whole thing is respect. I mean, even if you come up on an aggressive one, all they want you to do is leave. That's why they're aggressive. And there are certain groups out there, although not a whole lot, that go back to the cannibalistic ways, which just like we have on certain islands, we have cannibals there. Very few and far between do you see those. But generally, more times than not, what happens is if you have one ticked off, it's because you've come into an area you're not supposed to be in, or you've walked into an area they've got their children in, or they're doing something there. They just don't want you there. And so you just want to back out. Stay calm, you know, I'm not here to hurt you, and just leave. You know, you don't...
Are there any hand gestures to raise a hand,
well,
to show, it,
yeah,
you know, no weapons,
yeah,
that type of thing?
Yeah, and that's always a good thing. I mean, many, many people have seen where, and I've had countless calls where people will call me and say, you know, I have PTSD, I was attacked. Okay, did it hurt you? No. Did it touch you? No. Well, what did it do that you were attacked? It was waving its arms at me. Now, if you go back...
Yeah, it doesn't
and look
really
in the
sound
military,
like much of an attack.
No, it's not. But the thing is if you look in the military, when you're waving your hands above your head like that, that's a form of surrender.
Mm-hmm.
And in their case, where it may not be a surrender, it's simply, look, I'm not doing anything, but I don't want you here. Just please leave. You know, I mean, you don't know, are there families there? Are they hunting there? I've had certain ones stop me because where I was walking to, there was something worse out there that could have hurt me. You know, and they'll tell me, you need to leave now. Go now. It's not safe.
So they were warning you off for your own safety.
Yeah. Yeah, I've had that happen multiple times. And so you have to look at it. You can't go into any of these situations and say there's just one explanation, because the one thing about these guys is there isn't. There's no black or white. It's a multitude of gray all over the map. And you just can't go into it and say, well, this one did this, I know that's what it means. Because, number one, they have their own language. And they will make these straight, you know, the stick structures. And while there is stick structures that have what you would say universal meaning, I guess is the best way to put it, and that's lovely, there is just as many where the clans will go and alter some of them so that only the members of their clan know what they mean. So it kind of keeps everybody guessing, I guess is the best way to put it, because they really and truly, you know, some of them they want us to know. You know, like you get your large X's that are upright. That means stay out. But it also means stay out to other clans. So the fact that we now know about it doesn't really mean that it was put there for us, although a lot of them are. I've got one at the back of my property, and the only reason that was put up was because they get along not only with myself but my neighbor. And they've got an X in her far corner and an X in my far corner, so everything knows not to come in here. But at the same time, they don't want other clans to know. When you get the ones that are the X's and there's big poles on either side of it, that's a territorial marker. You don't even want to mess with that. You're now in a territory that you're not wanted. You know, and when you end up talking about something that really and truly, you know, can come up right on top of you and you can't see them, that's nothing you want to mess with. But where people get into trouble is they don't pay attention to what subtle signs they do get. You know, people say, well, it threw a rock at me. And the first thing I say is, okay, how big are we talking? Because if you're talking the size of an acorn and they're gently tossing them at you, they're doing that so that you know they're there and they're waiting to see what you're going to do back. It's kind of like, you know, we just did this. What are they going to do? Are they going to do something to hurt us? Are they going to do something to try to, you know, do something to our people? What's going on? You know, they used to do that to me. I'd be out in the woods and they would get little acorns and toss them on my back of my hair. I'm like, okay, I know you're there. You don't have to pelt me with, you know, and then I would hear laughter. So, you know, they weren't trying to hurt me. I knew they weren't trying to hurt me. And then you get other situations where it's per se like a rock, maybe the size, you know, of a baseball. Mm-hmm. And they're tossing them that way, but they don't hit you. If they want to hit you, they do not miss. They have perfect aim. They don't miss. So if you're not getting hit with it and it's hitting side, either, you know, not making it all the way to you or off to the side of you, they're doing that because they're trying to be nice and they're trying to tell you, you're not wanted there. Get out. You know, you're not supposed to be there. They're trying to give you a gentle warning so that you take the hint and leave on your own so that there's no altercations. Then you get the big boulder size. When you start getting those boulder size, if you are still stupid enough to stay there, then whatever happens is on you. Because they don't miss. And they pretty much let you know when you've crossed that line. You know, it has to do with if you're going to be out in the woods, you're in their world, and you're in the world of the other cryptids. And you just have to really be aware of your surroundings. For the most part, when you walk out in the woods, they all scatter and they give you a wide girth so that you can do whatever you're going to do, especially like with the hunters. But then if you persist and you're going deeper and deeper and deeper in the woods and now their backs are against the wall because there's only so far back they can go, they're going to make sure that you don't go any farther. You know, and they will steal an occasional deer from the hunters. I know multiple people, they've done that too. I had a friend of ours that was bow hunting on our property back in Michigan. And we knew he had said he was going to go back there. We were gone for the day. We came back and he come running out of the woods and ran up to the car and said, why didn't you tell me that you had somebody in a white gorilla suit walking around the woods? And I'm like, yeah, because we're so wealthy that, you know, we hire all these people to dress up in animal costumes to just walk around the woods just in case somebody happens to show up and go back there, you know. And he's like, no, no. He said, I was getting ready to pull, I was pulling up on a deer, and I went to go shoot it, and it walked up and grabbed the deer before I could kill it. And I have another friend that him and his brother were out on their own property, shot a deer, followed the blood trail, and then all of a sudden the blood trail just vanished. And they heard a gurgling noise, like a low growl, and they turned around, and here's this Bigfoot standing at the deer over its back, shoulder, and turned around and walked away. You know, I mean, they will try to do what they can to avoid an altercation for the most part. And I tell this to people all the time, the bad ones are lethal. They really and truly are. But the good ones, it's the purest, deepest love you'll ever understand, because we as our type humans do not comprehend how deep the love is from them. It's a whole different ball game. It literally will bring you to tears. And anybody that experiences that, they do what I call the love bubble, or like a love hug or whatever. And they can do where they project emotions from them onto you, whether that be fear, happiness, sadness, love, whatever. And there have been times where I've done something that they've wanted me to do and they're grateful or whatever, and they'll push that love on you, and it will literally make you cry. I just had this conversation with somebody the other day because he went out with the clan that he interacts with, and he said he walked out in that woods, and he said he got hit with it from all sides, and he said, I just dropped to my knees and cried, because it's the purest love that you'll ever, ever comprehend. Like, you can't even imagine it. And I recently went back to Michigan, and when I went back to Michigan, I went out to the woods in an area that I had gone to multiple times, my husband and I did, for years. And I hadn't been there since we left. And I went out there, and the second I walked into the woods, I got hit with it. And it wasn't, you know, that I was sentimental about being in the woods, because I'd already driven into it for ways. You know, I wasn't emotional at all. And then it was just like you just get hit, you know. And it's phenomenal.
It was welcoming for you.
Definitely. It's like getting this big, huge hug, you know, that you absolutely love. But the thing of it is, you know, with the good is the bad. And the bad ones can project fear on you that will terrify you to your core. And all the cryptids can do that. But they do that because they literally want you out of their way. They don't want you there. So there are a lot of things that they'll do before a full-blown attack. And if you miss them, you miss them. You know, you do have some that will just come flying at you. But for the most part, the normal is that there are slight warnings.
I know in your experience, and again, I think you have an extraordinary experience with interactions with Bigfoot and cryptids. What do they seek you for? What do they seek out from you? Do they ask you for something that you can provide that they couldn't get from another source? Do they look at you as a resource? What is their relationship,
you know,
to engage
I think
with
there's,
you?
There's a lot of people out there that they communicate with, that they go to for various things. I don't think I'm anything special. I might be to them, but I mean on an average, you know, whole. I was a stay-at-home mom. That's what I did. Did the mortgage business for a while. I'm about as ordinary as anybody can get. To them, in my particular case, like, they find people that they get close to for a number of things. They think they're number one pure of heart, which just, you know, means that they've got a pure heart and a giving and a loving heart. And then they have others that they connect with for that same reason, but then they want specific things from them. Right now, there's a lot of things going on this planet, and it's almost like they're getting their own little, I don't want to say military because that's too harsh of a word, but their own group of people gathered up. In my case, I do healing on them. I do energy work, which means I'm going to do energy work on the land and different various things. They send me all over the place. They've sent me to Texas. They've sent me to Tennessee. They've sent me to Pennsylvania. I mean, they literally will send me wherever they need me to go to do whatever it is that they think that they need me to do. So I think that has part of it. But they've been around me my whole life, and they didn't really start putting me to work until probably I want to say 2013, maybe 2012. And they'd been around me my whole life, but they'd been teaching me stuff my whole life too. So I think that has a lot to do with it. But they're bringing a lot of people into the fold. Okay, Doreen Fisher, who is part of what they call the crypto crew. She does the crypto crew with Thomas Markham. And in Doreen's case and in John's case, this part affects John as well, they've told me point blank, they are messengers. And by that, they mean that they are in a position that they can get the information out that they want out. When they first started wanting, I mean, they try every few years to try to come out and get people to understand that they're not these monsters and that they are a human or a type of human. And they really would love to be on a peaceful note with us. And the ones that don't just want to be left alone. You know, they don't really want anything from us. They never have, other than just to be left to live their lives. And we just can't seem to do that. So, like, in John and Doreen's case, John, because he does the conferences, he has this podcast, and Doreen, she's a writer, and she, you know, is a public figure. So in both of their cases, they tend to glomp onto them because they are what they call messengers. Everybody has their own little role that they use to play in. I mean, but they also live their lives under the rule or the law of Ra, which is the law of one. So they look at everything as a collective. They don't look at everything as, oh, hi, look at me, which is what our people do. Our people are so filled with ego, it's ridiculous. And there's really no room for ego. You know, it's like people will come to me and say, oh, you're an expert. Oh, no, I'm not. Oh, no. No expert here. I don't believe that there are experts in this, because for everything we know, there are 3 million more things that we will never know because they will never let us know. So I don't believe that anybody is an expert. I also don't believe that because I might have X amount of experiences and this person over on the other side only has one, I'm not any more valuable than that person is, because he may be able to shed some light on something I don't know, or maybe I can shed some light on something that will be beneficial to that person. And you work as a collective, and this is what's wrong with our country. This is what's wrong with our world. And they've tried repeatedly to teach us this, and we, as our humans, are just not the brightest apples in the orchard. We just don't get it. But that's how they live their world, even though their world, you know, is with ours.
It's for a kind of a topical event, has the COVID pandemic affected the Bigfoot people?
Oh, yeah. They, when we first started coming out with, and finding out that COVID existed, or whatever the government is calling COVID, okay, we created it. But whatever this virus is, this COVID, it affects them as well. They have human lineage in them. So, therefore, they are susceptible to that. Now, the other part of them, which would be the ETs don't get it. And I'm one that if I have a question, I go to the source. So I simply ask the ETs, you know, why aren't you getting it? It has to do with something in their blood. It has to, or whatever runs through their veins and their body chemistry. They don't get it. But according to them, the biggest reason they don't get it is the dimensions. And the ETs don't really necessarily go, I mean, they can go through dimensions, but they don't, you know, they come down here in ships and everything else, but that doesn't mean they can't go through the dimensions. But they don't get it where we do. And so when COVID first hit, I decided that, you know, since I do a lot of healing for the foots, I was going to be on call big time, because we had had an episode back in roughly 2015, where they had gotten quite sick with some stuff that the Dracos had dropped on everything. It came into the lungs that looked like a black tar. And myself, my husband, and a friend of mine that works with me as well on this, we were literally working 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, trying, you know, I do the healing, and then those guys run buffer and communicate, because we verify everything 3 times over to make sure we all get the same thing. If we don't get the same thing when we're speaking to them telepathically, then we don't do anything, because we can't, there's no room for error. So when COVID hit, I decided I needed to find out what was going to be workable for them out in the woods. So I went about, you know, pine needle tea, the vitamins in the pine needle tea are essential for them to fight COVID. Certain squashes are vital. And basically all the vitamins that they tell us to take, the C, the zinc, all of these things that we can just simply go to a pharmacy and get, I needed to find out how they could find it out in the woods, and that's exactly what I did. And then once I found out how they could obtain these things and what they could do, then I got hold of all my contacts, which I have all over the globe. I work with people everywhere, and said, okay, you need to get this information to your clients because they're going to have it. And it has been helpful. I've had a few cases where I think that's probably what they have. Obviously, you can't run a test on it, but they had all the symptoms. But it seems to have helped. I mean, they say that they, you know, are taking these things. Whether or not they are, who knows. But so it's been, you know, it hasn't been as bad as I was concerned it would be. But, yeah, they absolutely get it.
Mm-hmm.
And they get the common cold just like we do. Pat and I were out in the front yard the other night, and one was sneezing in the bushes.
So they do the same things that we do, essentially.
Yep.
They live.
Pretty much. I mean,
happy,
way of life is a little bit different. But, yeah.
Okay. Robin. Yeah, we got about 8 minutes. Yeah, Trey, please finish up with a good question for us.
What's their diet like? You said sometimes they might pick up a deer here and there. Do they cook the animals?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
I mean, they'll eat vegetables. They're carnivores. They're omnivores. They're going to eat vegetables. They're going to eat meat. They will chew on bark for medicinal purposes. You know, anything that they can get, they will use. But they do eat meat. I mean, I've heard people say, well, no, they're vegetarians. That is so not true. Unless maybe per se, I'm not going to say 100% of all of them. I don't know 100% of all of them. You know, we have people in our race or our species that are vegetarians that, very likelihood that they are with them, it's very possible, you know, or if maybe the time of year is such that they can get more vegetables than they can, you know, they like fruit, they like vegetables, they love sweets, and people gift them sweets all the time, and I always tell everybody, do it in moderation. They don't have a dentist. Decay is a real thing for them. Abscesses that can kill them are a real thing for them. So if you're going to gift, please be careful with the amount of sweets that you give them. They love them. They will absolutely eat as much as you give them. But, you know, be cautious with it because there aren't dentists out there.
Right. John, I feel like, as always, that I have taken advantage of the time I have to be with Robin and ask questions, but I'm not the only person on this panel. So
no,
please continue.
You've had some good questions. Devin, do you have any questions for Robin?
Yeah. No, I actually just loved listening to all the questions and answers and everything. It's so interesting to me.
Oh, you're so sweet,
Devin. It was making me think, you know, Robin, you were talking about, you know, humans and society and how we are so driven by ego and we don't work together. And
it reminded
me of that, you know, the movie War of the Worlds. And I just thought, you know, humans are so arrogant. We think, you know, something's going to happen to wipe humanity off the face of the earth. That's just the end of it. But there's so many other things that, you know, would maybe be better off.
Well, and we're the ones that are going to wipe humanity off the face of the earth.
Right.
I mean, it's that, you know, I mean, really,
yeah.
And like in the War of the Worlds, you know, it shows the bad ETs come and they create all these things. And there really is a lot of good ETs that are out there. That really some very, very kind ones that really want the best for us and want us to stop the disasters that we're creating, because we've done this all to ourselves. We didn't need them to do it. We've already done it. But the problem is with the bad stuff that we've created, it creates a negative, dark energy. And there are bad ETs out there, and not just ETs, things that come through the dimensions or, you know, anything that's negative in general. And they feed off of that negative energy that we're creating. And then they turn around and they keep poking at you and poking at you because they want to blow up your world. And if they can keep your world torn apart or you upset or whatever, it continues that cycle of negative energy. And it's never ending. And it just feeds them and gives them strength. the only way we can stop what is going to happen as far as the battle that's being fought on this planet right now, which is basically a good versus evil, and it's not just among our people. It has to do with everything in the rifts, the dimensions, the portals, elementals, dimensionals, ETs, cryptids, all of that stuff. It's like this big battle that's been going on for about 3 or 4 years now, and it had been getting amped up for it for multiple years before that. And the only thing that's going to really push it more in our favor is the positive energy. And so this is another reason that the Bigfoots are working with a lot of people and kind of getting them in the fold right now, because they need that positive energy. And they're very careful with who they're picking out, and it's working. Okay, we're not way ahead of the game right now. We've got a little bit of an edge. And this is a good thing. But, again, you know, we are the biggest problem. We are the bent link in the chain, unfortunately.
Yeah.
And it's like everybody's trying to save our butts, but we're the only ones that aren't doing anything to save our butts.
Yeah.
Okay, Ralph, do you have any questions for Robin?
I've enjoyed listening so much, and I appreciate her knowledge and her knowledge base. It's just wonderful.
Oh, thank you. That's very kind. Thank you.
And we'll
I appreciate
we'll have
it. I'm always surprised anybody wants to hear about it besides me. I appreciate you guys.
No, we enjoy it, Robin. And I want to say thank you to everyone that's here with us. Next week, we're going to have Ralph back, and we're going to have Ralph talk about his paranormal experiences. Robin's going to comment, and same thing with Devin about the paranormal experiences he had with his friend Amy, who passed away, and some of the things that Robin had to say, and Trey and I will be here listening and having a great time. So I wanted to say thank you to everybody for being here with us on ScaryCast. We'll be back next week, and also... Now, Ralph, next Sunday, where will you be?
We'll be in Dirty Don's Oyster Bar, both in Myrtle Beach, North Myrtle Beach, 21st Avenue in Myrtle Beach, and on the boardwalk.
All right. Well, we'll come out and see you. And thanks a lot. Glad to have you. Glad to have everybody. We'll see everybody
and
next
Trey,
week on the
one
wood.
Comment for Trey.
Oh,
Trey,
yes.
You need to get my phone number from John so you and I can have conversations on the phone so you can ask more questions.
Well, I will make sure to text Trey your phone number. So anyway, thanks a lot to everybody. Glad you've been on with us. And we'll see you next week on the one, the only, ScaryCast. Take care, everybody.
Take care, everybody.
Bye.
Bye.